Hello and welcome to Didion Hawthorne in the In-Between, or DH&I. I'm your host, Mackenzie Gentz, and you're listening to our podcast about the relevance of literature in the 21st century. Now bookmark that book, and let's begin. Hello, hello, welcome to the show. Hallo und herzlich willkommen zu unserem Podcast. Today we are going over the short story Flashlight by Susan Choi. I read this short story in The New Yorker the day it came out on August 31st, 2020. This is in the September 7th issue. This is not an ad for The New Yorker, by the way. I used to be a subscriber there and I'm no longer a subscriber. I just did not use it enough as some German newspapers that I do subscribe to. But I thought this was a really worthwhile exercise and a really interesting short story to go over, so I'm going to walk you through how I read a short story, the things I look for. Of course, I have already read this before. I did speed read it the first time. This time I'm going to do a very slow, in-depth reading, and I'm going to walk you through my thoughts as we go through the short story. I'm not going to be reading the whole thing out loud. I think that's pretty much illegal, but I will be excerpting from this short story. It's linked down below in the show notes. Alright, so Flashlight by Susan Choi. I don't know who Susan Choi is. I like her writing. I think it's a really good exercise. At least this short story is a really good exercise in deliberate omission, which is something I've been seeing in a lot of fiction nowadays, not just fiction from The New Yorker and other magazines. The first line of this story, "One thing I will always be grateful to your mother for, she taught you to swim." What's interesting here is I initially thought, oh, she taught you how to swim. That's sort of the meaning there. But why is that word not there? I'm sort of puzzled over this. She taught you to swim. And this girl, this little girl, as I'm remembering, doesn't really like to swim. She can swim, but she just doesn't really like it. And so the meaning of she taught you to swim, as in she taught you to love to swim, also doesn't fit here. So it's a very ambiguous sort of first line where there's this kind of, I think it introduces some sort of idiosyncrasy on the father's part and how he's talking. Going on in the story, why? Not asked as a question, but groaned as a protest. Louisa does not want her father to talk about her mother. She is sick of her mother. Her mother can do nothing right. This is the theme of their new life, in Louisa's opinion, that Louisa and her father are two fish who should leave her beached mother behind. And this is some really strong language, some really strong feeling from this character, Louisa. We learn Louisa is a child. She's quite young in this first vignette that we get from her. Not a very long passage of this memory of sorts, Louisa and her father. And it's just so, what strikes me about it is she's pitting her father and her mother against each other. She's saying, it's me and my father against the world, against my mother. And so this mother figure does not start out as being very strong at all. But as we go through, we also see that her father is not a super strong figure in her life. And so this father figure, he's wearing a full suit. He clearly works a lot. He clearly works some corporate kind of job with crazy hours, etc. And he's wearing this suit while they're walking along the breakwater on this beach. And they must, as I've deduced from reading the rest of the story, they must be in Japan. But they're really going down the list here and talking about the swimming issue. She says later in this passage, quote, "I don't care, I hate swimming." And so there's just sort of this dichotomy between the two where the father almost has this heightened kind of perspective, whereas Louisa is down and very much entrenched in her own emotions. Something interesting also to me is that the author takes careful care to describe this situation where her parents are sort of ostracized from Louisa, or maybe vice versa. Maybe Louisa is the one that's ostracized. Her mother is ill. We don't know if she's playing ill or if she is actually ill. That's a big question of this short story. And then her father is obviously working, very separate from their lives as well. And so this moment where she's walking with him on the breakwater,
it's a huge moment of contrast and conflict, at least for me as I'm reading, because he's in this suit, but Louisa is, you know, playing basically on this beach, and they're walking together in this very casual setting, and yet her father refuses to let go of his work persona. Maybe he's going into work soon or something, but it is this contrast where there's this suit and he's walking along the beach with his young daughter, no less trying to convince her that swimming and playing in the water is fun. And he explains, "I never learned how to swim." So this is important information as well in the first part of this thing. And Louisa is a really interesting character in this thread that we get from her, because she is very oppositional. And I can definitely relate to this, especially when I was in high school. I was a very oppositional kind of commentator on things, especially in discussions and things. When I finally learned how to get out of my shell a little bit, I decided to deliberately just be oppositional all the time. And it's a tiring, exhausting thing to be, and it's something that I don't think is necessarily productive at all points. But I just sort of smiled when I realized, oh, this Louisa figure is a little bit like myself in a lot of ways. And then this big surprise, there's sort of this shattering effect that happens at the end of this first little passage here. These are the last words he ever says to her. Or are they just the last words that she can remember? Did he say something more? There is no one to ask. That last bit is in parentheses. And this is interesting to me. It's sort of, I thought that initially when I read this, I thought that the parentheses part, or are they just the last words that she can remember, etc., I thought that was a little bit overkill for me. And now that I'm reading back, I think it's a little bit more artistic than I initially wanted for the ending of this first section. It is a little bit kitschy just to end with, "These are the last words he ever says to her." It's a big gut punch. It's kind of a sucker punch. And I think that one thing that the author Choi is trying to do here to mitigate that effect a little bit is adding that parenthesis and adding sort of this headiness or this mental ease kind of structure to what we're doing when we're following Louisa in the narrative. So I'm ambivalent about the effect of this parentheses at the end of the section, but I don't think that it's completely unnecessary as I did the first time I read it. So this next section starts, "Louisa lay awake, staring into the dark. The ceiling showed itself in a narrow stripe of light, the first sharp like a blade, and then becoming softer and softer, which began at the door frame where the door was very slightly cracked open." The first thing that I noticed when I read this the first time is that there's a big tense shift here. This is in past tense, obviously. The first bit is in present tense, which makes it feel very fleeting, very immediate, like it's a memory. And we do find out at the end of the section that it is a memory, but here we are in the narrative proper. And this is a really interesting setup to me, because we have this very short nugget of memory to start with. And then when we get into the narrative proper, it's very long, it's very drawn out, but it has this same sort of quality, like Louisa is not there. It's sort of fragmented. And I haven't seen this sort of setup in a long time. It's been probably a couple years since I read a short story with sort of a similar way to start. So I thought it was really cool for Choi to do this thing where it starts out with this very immediate scene and then goes into where we are now, or where we are at least in the moment that we are observing Louisa. Going into this next paragraph, we start hearing about Louisa's mother again. Quote, "After she said it, there would be another brief hesitation, which Louisa didn't mind because it showed that her mother was indeed satisfyingly hurt. Apparently, her mother would have liked Louisa to ask for a story or a kiss as if Louisa were still 5 years old," unquote. And here I was thinking, okay, Louisa must be in her teens now. You know, Louisa must be 14, 13, something like this, and her mother just doesn't get that she's growing up. Maybe since she's lost her father, the mother is trying to do double duty, like the moms. But we learn that Louisa is quite young. She's in fourth grade. And so there's this sort of, again, this sort of weird disconnect between what we're seeing from Louisa and what we know to be true in real life. And so Louisa has this very adversarial kind of view of her mother. And we learn later in the story, there's a very poignant bit that's coming up about these little dollhouses that Louisa would obsess over. And the store in the mall that they would go to was quite expensive, and her mother's very cheap, so she never was able to really get furniture or a dollhouse from that store. But her father saw that, and he saw the price tag, and he said, I can make this. And so, you know, it's sort of this, again, this pitting of her parents against each other and pitting of her mother against her. And it seems like she very much is not receiving the kind of love that she would like to receive from her mother, and certainly not the kind of love that she would like to reciprocate. I was reading the first part of this short story with one of my students, and I was talking with them about Louisa as a character, and this person is a psychiatrist, and they said to me, oh, it's clear to me that Louisa is mentally ill. It's clear to me that there's some problem that's really distinct going on with her. And what was interesting to me is that I didn't see that at all when I was reading this short story the first time. I really thought, you know, Louisa's just odd. She's just a grown-up young lady. And that was, to a big extent, that was also how I was when I was younger. I was very grown up, and I think that authors nowadays in short stories, what I'm seeing as a general trend is a lot of them are looking towards how to represent the capacity of children in their writing. I have a friend who says the same thing to me every time we meet, which is that I think that children are incredibly perceptive, incredibly bright, and that they just don't know how to articulate certain things yet. And I think this is right, and I think this is one thing that Susan Choi is bringing out in her short stories, how perceptive and how incredibly bright Louisa is, despite her age. So we get this sort of more adult perspective, but it's just because we're not used to children being able to articulate these kinds of things yet. And I know that this is from the third person omniscient view, of course, so it's not Louisa really articulating these things, but it does seem like the thoughts are there in Louisa's mind. And to me, that doesn't signify really a mental illness, but more so signifies this sort of trend of people really wanting to represent children differently in literature. In the next few paragraphs, we start to learn a little bit more about Louisa's new situation. She's living with her aunt and uncle, her mother's living with her, and her mother's in a wheelchair. And we get these bits very sparingly, I will just point that out, and we get them late. And so it's interesting to me, it sort of creates this weird suspense almost in the narrative. You know, I got this really poignant definition of suspense from Malcolm Gladwell. I'm taking one of his writing classes. And he says, suspense is the writer playing with your expectations around time. And I think this is totally the case here, and something I really am struggling to learn in my own writing and my own process. And that's exactly what Choi is doing at this point in the narrative. She's saying, here are the details of Louisa's situation, but to me, as a reader, my expectation was that they were going to come much earlier, or that we would have more context clues earlier. It's more so that we're sticking in Louisa's headspace, or the narrator is trying to stick to Louisa's headspace, and then starts to finally give us more information later. So Louisa is going to a child psychologist. Initially, they tell her a lie that she is going to talk about her grade level. She's been held back a grade So I'll just excerpt this here. Quote, on moving here to Los Angeles, she'd been put into fourth grade when she should have been a fifth grader. She had been halfway through fourth grade when she and her parents had left the U.S. for a year in Japan, and during their time there, she had finished fourth grade, done all the workbooks and readings and tests that her parents had brought on the trip, and she'd finished the Japanese fourth grade as well. Unquote. So it's really interesting because to me, I don't see Louisa as having a good advocate here. Clearly her aunt is not a good advocate. Louisa sees her aunt as very annoying, very almost incompetent in a lot of ways. Her mother she sees in a very similar way, just as someone who, you know, has control over her but isn't responsible in that way for her. And that's concerning to me, that she's this clearly bright individual who has no advocate, and this child psychologist, the meeting is quite different. But again, to my earlier point, we're just now getting that information about Japan. This is the point a little bit through that we can place, okay, probably that accident with her dad occurred in Japan while they were in Japan. It could have been also that he drowned. There's more info about that later. As I continue on here and she's sort of remembering little tidbits from her current situation as she's in the child psychologist's office, one of the things that I'm picking up on here is this theme of deception. So the adults try to deceive Louisa to get her to do things like go to the appointment in general. Louisa has to essentially deceive others about some of what she's thinking and some of how she's reacting to things. And we learn a lot of serious information about Louisa and what's going on with Louisa. For example, she steals things, she lies, she gets deliberately, it seems like, into trouble. This could be, though, her way of, you know, as a kid, you have very limited options for acting out. You can't drive yet, you can't technically get your hold of substances and things like that yet. At least one would hope not. And so one way of her getting her parents' attention and getting people's attention through this really must be really frustrating state of not being able to articulate things properly, or maybe not being able to be heard properly. It seems like that's one of her other issues, is that people don't take her seriously because she's so little. So one of the ways for her to get people's attention is through acting out and through stealing things, and she finds great comfort in that little bit of control that she can take over her own life, because this is a world that is very much governed by who, again, she thinks as incompetent adults. I'm getting ahead of myself, though. We are in the section that most stuck out to me in this short story, which is about the dollhouses. And so she sees a dollhouse in the psychologist's room, and she starts to talk about this store. It's a small world, and how everything was perfect and miniature, and how it was sort of a microcosm of life, and how everything was very ornate and dainty and beautiful to her. And her father makes this rough and tumble kind of version of one of those dollhouses. And at first, quote, Louisa had been horrified by the clumsy, indelicate house, though her horror was silent. Her father's labor awed and grieved her. Unquote. And I love this little passage. I think that her father's labor awed and grieved her. That line is so poignant and beautiful and describes the situation so super well, because her father gets home from work and he just works on the dollhouse hours and hours and hours of his time, and the dollhouse ends up being so ugly and gross. But over time, as her parents help her furnish this dollhouse, it's sort of that this one moment in this short story that we get of true harmony between the three of them. Quote, her mother perhaps helped reveal it by sewing tiny pillows and bedspreads and the bed canopy, by showing Louisa that postage stamps could be put into brown cardboard frames to make art for the walls. Unquote. And so that's just one example where it's sort of this, them working together to create something and them communicating in ways that are perhaps silent, but also very instructive and very empowering for Louisa, and indeed I think empowering for this whole small family here. And then Louisa sort of falls in love with the house, and there's a couple of items that her parents get her for special occasions from that store. It's a small world, like little grand piano, which I think is pretty adorable. But she realizes that this, the nice furniture, the stuff that is actually from It's a Small World, suddenly looks wrong in her homemade ramshackle little dollhouse. And then we get to, in this conversation with her and the psychologist, this theme of light in the short story. And this is something I haven't completely pieced together yet. I think it's very ambiguous and very much up to interpretation. So her father is sort of a hypochondriac, but like a hypochondriac, but with certain emergency disaster type situations. So I don't know what that word is. He's just overly prepared, maybe. And he takes the flashlight, even when it's midday, he'll take this flashlight with him on him and Louise's walks. And he's sort of just always prepared, but of course, in a great bout of irony, he's the one who ends up dying, not Louisa. And Louisa remembers the flashlight her father was carrying when she last saw him when the accident happened in Japan. And so she sees this flashlight. There's all these great miraculous toys in the psychologist's office, and she is looking at them. She doesn't want to give too much away about herself, though, so she doesn't want to play with any of them. And then she sees the flashlight, and they start talking about Japan. Quote, she was disappointed somehow that he already knew this, that she lived in Japan, but of course, he already knew everything. Can we turn out the lights? It won't be dark. You could pull the blinds down. It still won't be dark. It will be dim, Dr. Brickner predicted, but he was already doing it. And she takes glee in how inconvenient these blinds are to him, and how inconvenient the whole situation is to him. And it seems like I like Dr. Brickner. It seems like he is going to get through to her, and there is that hope through that situation. We find out at the end of the story that Dr. Brickner obviously finds out that Louisa does steal the flashlight from him, and a very characteristic move, but I do think that there's some hope for this situation between them, and this conversation sheds a lot of light on the whole situation. It gives us a lot more information about Louisa in terms of how she reacts to things, how she interacts with people, especially when there's a person designated just to pay attention to her and just to, I hope in the future, be an advocate for her, because that's what it seems like she really needs. But yeah, this theme of light and dark, and Louisa is staring at this stripe that her door creates on the ceiling, presumably a hall light is on or something. And it seems like there's a combination of fear and fascination, and almost like she has very high walls up, and this recognition that light plays into, and that little strip of light and flashlights especially play into her trauma with her father. I think that also is something she tries to avoid, and that manifests as sort of this fear of the dark, this fear of light, and maybe a fear of being recognized, a fear of being truly seen, because she's been so hidden, she's been so ostracized, for lack of a better word, for so long that it almost seems to me like she doesn't want people to truly get to know her. And that is the point at which I do think my student's observation was somewhat correct, that she does have this sort of, not a mental illness in my opinion, but something that's wrong with her because of the trauma, you know, and it's just the trauma itself sort of bubbling over in her life. And I'm not an expert about these things, I should say. I read the DSM for kicks sometimes, but I'm not a trained psychologist. Please don't listen to anything I'm saying as like advice for your life or anything like that. I'm just couch diagnosing this fictional character here. And as we're coming to a close on this short story here, I wanted to end with a bit of light. I wanted to end with a happier theme, and this is later in the psychologist and her discussion, and he's reading out a bunch of her different faults, a bunch of her different crimes. And she goes, "What's that?" she interrupted. "Which?" "The last one, Larson something." "Larceny, a fancy word for stealing." "I've never heard that." "Do you mean you didn't know that you were accused of stealing?" "No, I've never heard that word, Larson." "Larceny. We've found the limits of your 10-year-old's vocabulary. Would you like to talk about larceny? You don't look very sorry about it." "I'm not." It's just a really interesting, cool, funny dialogue because this is his way in. She's curious. She loves words. She has this respect for learning and this respect for being adult and growing her mind in that way. And so that was something, that's a little bit of the story that I found intensely hopeful. And this story does end in a way that is full of a mission, full of things that we just don't know and will never know and have to either let be or just make up for ourselves. So there's a lot here, a little bit before the ending, that I'm taking to heart to say, okay, hopefully there's some hope, there's some light in terms of Louisa's future. The last scene of this short story is her mother coming into her room, basically jumping onto her bed, and Louisa says, quote, "Her mother didn't need the chair she was faking," unquote. And I am not sure that how fabricated this is. In other words, is Louisa making this up? Does Louisa think something that's false? That's completely possible. And I guess the thing is that because this perspective is so limited and so guided, we will never know. And so with this, I want to believe Louisa because we're following Louisa, because that's the only character we know and think we can trust in this story. But again, there's a lot of ambiguity here. And the last line of the short story is, quote, "Now her aunt was also busying into the scrum," unquote. And scrum, I had to look this one up, is an agile framework for developing, delivering, and sustaining complex products. So it seems like it's a software development program, but in terms of like dictionary.com-ing it, it is an ordered formation of players, which it seems to me like that's the perfect last line. It's a very thoughtful last line because here we have this word to describe basically this big chess game that Louisa finds as her life.
If you enjoyed the discussion and would like to hear more from us, there's a show and a series for everyone, so I'd recommend checking out our website, relevanceofliterature.com, under the ongoing series tab for links to our entire back catalog of episodes. We also have a couple of open surveys that you can find through the links in the description, so if you have 3 minutes while you're waiting in line somewhere, we would very much appreciate your feedback on our show. Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode, and we'll see you next time.